Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 21. Asa Gilbert Eddy. Some 3 years before that obdurate separatist John Baker left his native village of Liminge in Kent in 1634 and set out for the New World, two young men, John and Samuel Eddy, sons of the Reverend William Eddy, vicar of Cranbrook, another Kentish village not far from Liminge, had made the same journey. John Baker, it will be remembered, ultimately built himself a grist mill on the outskirts of Boston and prospered greatly. John and Samuel Eddy took up land not far from Salem and devoted themselves to farming. Whether the three ever met, it is impossible to say. The colony was still a small one, and they came from neighboring villages in England. They may have met. In any case, the Eddies, too, seem to have prospered, John especially. And in the 1830s, Asa Eddy, the son of Abel, the son of Ebenezer, the son of Samuel, the son of Samuel, the son of John, still a farmer, was living in Londonderry, Vermont. He and his wife, Betsy, had several children, of whom Asa Gilbert was the next to the youngest. Farming in Vermont in the early part of last century was very much the same as farming in New Hampshire at that time, a constant struggle, late and early, with the inexorable demand everywhere upon everyone to do his share. In the case of the Eddies, the situation was rendered somewhat different by reason of the fact that Betsy Eddy, far from yielding to custom in this respect, had the most original ideas as to her status and obligations. She had a passion for driving, and as soon as the children were old enough to go to school, she would, after seeing them safely delivered at the schoolhouse, set out with her horse and buggy and drive all day long around the countryside. There is no record that Asa Sr. ever protested. He was less inclined to do so, perhaps, because in the evenings, Betsy would train her children, boys and girls alike, in all the arts of housekeeping. They were taught not only to cook and sew, wash and iron, but to spin their own wool, weave their own cloth, and make their own clothes. The more successful she was as a teacher, the more she was relieved of household cares, and the more time she could take off to indulge her ruling passion. At first, she was influenced to a certain extent by weather conditions, remaining at home if the day was wet or stormy. But later, finding such restraint irksome, she fashioned for herself a kind of helmet on the diver principle. It was made of thick cloth, was attached more or less rigidly to her shoulders, and had a 9 by 10 inch pane of window glass inserted in an opening opposite her face. The contrivance served, of course, as a perfect windshield, and with this protection she could venture out in all weathers in complete comfort. Then Betsy had unusual ideas about doctors. When she or any of the children was ill, her unfailing recourse was one Sleeping Lucy. Sleeping Lucy, whose right name was Lucy Cook, had a remarkable gift of nature. when summoned professionally to aid the sick, she just naturally went into a trance, and while thus conditioned, diagnosed the trouble and prescribed the remedy. Apparently, very much the same way as the boy Berkmar, it will be remembered, was doing for Quimby about the same time away at the other side of the mountains in Maine. Betsy, moreover, had a great love for fine clothes, and what was still more unusual in a New England housewife of 100 years ago, and a cause of still greater perplexity to her neighbors, she was credited with having a fine library. The boy, Asa Gilbert Eddy, who had taken up weaving as a trade, in the end inherited the farm. It was deeded to him in 1859 by his parents, on condition that he agreed to support them for the rest of their lives. They did not survive long. Betsy died in 1860, and the elder Asa 3 years later. Asa Gilbert continued to manage the farm for a time, but his heart was really not in farming, and before long he leased it and returned to his trade as a weaver. Asa Gilbert Eddy was a man of somewhat unequal parts and unusual traits. As a boy at school, he moved ahead steadily enough, and ultimately achieved a good common school education. But he was outstanding in nothing save in the art of penmanship. In this, even at a time when penmanship had many amazing exponents, he was apparently regarded as exceptional. In all his life, he delighted in its exercise. A rather small, mild-mannered man, he was just a little bit different in everything he did or affected. He designed his own clothes and the cloth from which they were made, and he secured the impression of added height by wearing his luxuriant hair in the highest possible pompadour style. He loved to play the violin and to draw animal pictures for little children. He was genial and candid and just naturally kind, and he had two other qualities which, later on, as they found occasion for exercise, were to overshadow all others: self-sacrifice and tenacity of purpose. When he first enters the record, about 1876, he is living in East Boston, working as an agent for a sewing machine company. Among his friends were a Mr. and Mrs. Godfrey, who lived in the little township of Chelsea, close by. Being a bachelor, living alone, he was often asked to their home. And one day early in 1876, on going to visit them, he was conscious at once that something unusual had happened. Mrs. Godfrey did not leave him long in doubt. She had, it appears, for some weeks previously, been suffering from a badly infected finger caused by a broken needle and complicated by poison from some colored thread. It was so serious that the doctor had advised amputation. Gilbert Eddy evidently knew all about it, and as the Godfreys had been away in Lynn for a few days, had come round on their return to see how Mrs. Godfrey was. When she showed him her finger, perfectly healed, he was naturally overjoyed, and eager to hear the story they were evidently more than eager to tell. And so they told him of how they had been invited by some friends who lived in Lynn and who knew of Mrs. Godfrey's trouble to visit them, how these friends had rooms in the house of a Mrs. Mary Patterson at No. 8 Broad Street, how they persuaded Mrs. Godfrey to ask Mrs. Patterson for help, how Mrs. Patterson had agreed to do what she could, and how when she, Mrs. Godfrey, got up next morning, her finger was perfectly well. Gilbert Eddy was immediately interested, and suffering from some minor ailment himself, was anxious to try the effect of the new treatment. The Godfreys had met Spofford at Lynn, and probably at their insistence, Gilbert went to consult him at his office in Boston. The result was all he could have wished. He recovered, if not instantly, at any rate so quickly and thoroughly as to make him eager to learn all he could, as soon as he could, about the new teaching. Spofford had no difficulty in persuading him to come with him to Lynn and meet Mrs. Patterson. The result of their meeting seems to have been an instant appreciation on both sides. And within a few days, Gilbert Eddy had enrolled himself in a class that Mary was then forming. Asa Gilbert Eddy was one of the most satisfactory of all Mrs. Patterson's students up to that time. He never seems to have hesitated a moment at any point. He accepted as truth what he was taught the first time Spofford explained it to him. Mrs. Patterson admitted him as a student as soon as she saw him. He entered a class she was forming, studied the usual 3 weeks, and at the end of that time assumed at once, with the usual ease, the title of doctor, and set to work, being the first of Mrs. Patterson's students to announce himself as a Christian Science practitioner. It was a clear-cut example of orderly development which might have occasioned in the hearts of the little band nothing but satisfaction and rejoicing. On the surface, all was calm. The calm, however, was very much of the kind that precedes a storm. Gilbert rose rapidly. He had a certain quiet capacity for getting things done and a sense of order, which to Mary, burdened at every turn by ever-increasing calls upon her time and attention, was an indescribable relief. She tended to lean upon him more and more, and to act, either actually or apparently, on his advice, often with all too drastic thoroughness. The slowness of the sale of Science and Health was perhaps what troubled her most. Already she was hard at work revising it and planning for a second edition. She could not, however, issue a second edition before the first had been sold and some of the necessary funds for the second edition thus made available. It was probably on the advice of Gilbert Eddy that she decided to take vigorous action. She asked Spofford to come to Lynn and go into the whole question with her. As a result, it was decided that Spofford should turn over part of his practice to Gilbert Eddy and devote all his available time to promoting the sale of Science and Health. In ordinary circumstances, such a plan might have worked very well. Spofford had built up quite a large connection and had had charge of the sale of the book since its publication. He was resourceful, and if his methods were sometimes somewhat crude, even for those days, he was enthusiastic and anxious to do the best he could. The circumstances were, however, far from ordinary. The rapid rise of Gilbert Eddy was being viewed by some of the older members of the group with steadily increasing disfavor. The advent of this 11th-hour worker, at a wage not only equal to, but obviously greater than their own, was the cause, at first, of much secret heart-burning, and later on, open rebellion. And the weeks and months which followed were to present as unlovely a picture of the results of petty jealousy as is possible to imagine. The first to reach the breaking point was George Berry. So long as he occupied the position of head man, his devotion knew no limits. He may have felt that the more indispensable he made himself, the higher must he be in the estimate not only of his teacher, but of his fellow students. He enjoyed this sunshine to the uttermost, apparently, and evidently had no idea of sharing the position with any newcomer like Gilbert Eddy. Mary tried to reassure him, but it was all to no purpose, and when she completed the new arrangement with Spofford and Gilbert Eddy for managing the sale of Science and Health, he went off in high dudgeon and refused to return. Spofford himself was hardly less disaffected. He appeared to acquiesce in the new plan wholeheartedly, but it became evident before very long that discontent over Gilbert Eddy was coloring his interpretation of every move that was made from Lynn. He went about his work without complaint, but without any enthusiasm or accomplishment. And Mary seems to have felt it all intensely. Indeed, there began to develop anew about this time with Mary Patterson and her followers a phase of thought which, although ultimately seen by Mary herself for what it was and definitely overcome, was to remain for many years a possible source of ever-recurring wrong development. It was a phase of the old Quimby belief that, in the process of healing, the healer took upon himself the griefs of his patient, and then proceeded to cast them out of his own thought and experience. The cruder phases of this theory had long been abandoned, but there remained the conviction that the healer was open to the mental demands of his patients and to the burden which his emotions, whether of anger, hatred, and resentment, and so forth, would impose if he were personally present. Apart from this, there can be no doubt that in addition to the cares of a young movement, Mary Patterson was subject day and night to calls from her students for healing for themselves and advice in healing of others. She had not yet reached the heights of her later teaching when she could affirm calmly, "Evil thoughts and aims reach no farther and do no more harm than one's belief permits. Evil thoughts, lusts, and malicious purposes cannot go forth like wandering pollen from one human mind to another, finding unsuspected lodgment. If virtue and truth build a strong defense. She was conscious in these months of a steadily growing burden, and with her feet still uncertainly planted in the new way, she was often fearful and anxious. Sometimes she reached a point almost of despair, as is clear from a long letter to Daniel Spofford written towards the close of 1876. Spofford had been complaining, insisting that he was being driven away from her, and in every way showing clearly that he was constantly mulling the whole thing over in a spirit of dissatisfaction and hurt. Mary is well nigh desperate. "Now, Dr. Spofford," she writes, "won't you exercise reason and let me live? Or will you kill me? Your mind is just what has brought on my relapse, and I shall never recover if you do not govern yourself and turn your thoughts wholly away from me. Do, for God's sake, and the work I have before me, let me go out of this suffering. I never was worse than last night. And you say you wish to do me good? And I do not doubt it. Then won't you quit thinking of me? I shall write no more to a male student, and never more trust one to live with. It is a hidden foe that is at work. Read Science and Health, page 193, first paragraph. No student nor mortal has tried to have you leave me that I know of. Dr. Eddy has tried to have you stay. You are in mistake. It is God, not man, that has separated us, and for the reason I begin to learn. Do not think of returning to me again. I shall never again trust a man. They know not what manner of temptations assail. God produces the separation, and I submit to it. So must you. There is no cloud between us, but the way you set me up for a dagon is wrong. And now I implore you to return forever from this error of personality and go alone to God as I have taught you. It is mesmerism I feel, and it is killing me. It is mortal mind only that can make me suffer. Now stop thinking of me, or you will cut me off soon from the face of the earth." It is the letter of a sorely tried and fear-filled woman, and is chiefly significant for the contrast it presents to the calmness and serenity pervading her later dealings with much more difficult situations. In these early days, there is abundant evidence that Mary Patterson was, at times, fearfully conscious that she was advancing into a realm of thought hitherto unexplored, that she was leaving old landmarks behind her, and that there was no human being of whom she could inquire the way or even take counsel as to its probable direction. The spirit was willing, and not only willing, but inflexibly determined. Nothing, apparently, could turn her aside. All through these years of struggle and disappointment, she must have been aware that she could free herself and return, almost at will, to a life of ease and comfort with her people at Tilton. From the one bitter letter she was to receive from Abigail some 10 years later, it was clear enough that, So deeply did her sister feel the talk and criticism that Mary's actions had brought upon her. She would have welcomed any prospect of their being abandoned with all her heart and at almost any cost. But if the spirit was willing and inflexible, the flesh was often weak. And this letter to Spofford reveals Mary Patterson down in one of those deeps, plumbed at times by every prophet, great or small, whether without the walls of Ur of the Chaldees or Jerusalem. It was an experience she was often to have in the future. As she puts it, looking back over the years in her book Retrospection and Introspection, a realization of the shifting scenes of human happiness and of the frailty of mortal anticipations, such as first led me to the feet of Christian Science, seems to be requisite at every stage of advancement. Though our first lessons are changed, modified, broadened, yet their core is constantly renewed, as the law of the cord remains unchanged, whether we are dealing with a simple Latour exercise or with the vast Wagner trilogy. In the midst of it all, a strange thing happened. Gilbert Eddy asked her to marry him. It might be assumed she had no thought of it, and that marriage held little attraction for Mary Patterson. The tragedy of her first marriage, followed by the long, drawn-out misery and disappointment of her second, left little in the prospect that anyone should desire it. She was 56 years old, and Gilbert was some 10 years younger. Moreover, she had now in life just one great, all-absorbing purpose. She could not think of it, and so she refused him. But that night, she had a dream. A very common incoherency begotten of the troubles of the day, in which she found herself wandering in a wheat field, surrounded by swinish forms, fearful and alone, and quite at a loss as what to do. Then, suddenly, she was conscious of a very simple, honest presence close at hand. And next moment, she heard a voice saying to her, "Come on, Mary, I will help you." It was Gilbert Eddy, of course. They were married the next day, New Year's Day, 1877, with a suddenness confounding to Spofford, coming hard upon her renunciatory letter of 2 days before. That they entertained a real affection for each other, which only deepened as the years passed, seems clear enough. But Mrs. Eddy, as she indicated later on in one of her books, had at this time, and always afterwards, one dominant preoccupation. Gilbert Eddy, as will be seen, shared this ambition and this joy with amazing faithfulness and loyalty. And because she recognized these qualities, Mary Patterson found the promise of security and encouragement in him. No doubt they hoped, too, that by their marriage they would put an end to the petty jealousies which had made their useful cooperation so difficult. And their hopes in this direction were, to a certain extent, justified. At any rate, as far as the rank and file were concerned. To George Berry and Daniel Spofford, as will be seen, it was the last straw. But the rest of the little group, after they had recovered from the first surprise, rallied round their teacher with renewed affection and loyalty. Indeed, it quickly became clear that, coming as it did at a time when a vague sense of uneasiness as to the ultimate demands of the new teaching was beginning to make itself felt, the very simple human act of this marriage had a wholesomely clarifying effect. There is something very homely and accustomed about the Lynn reporter's account of the celebration of the event, which was held at the Broad Street house a few weeks later. Under the caption, Christian Scientists Festival, and under date February 10, 1877, the account runs, "A very pleasant occasion of congratulations and bridal gifts passed off at the residence of the bride and bridegroom, Dr. and Mrs. Eddy, at No. 8 Broad Street, on the evening of the 31st ultimate. The arrival of a large number of unexpected guests at length brought about the discovery that it was a sort of semi-surprise party, and thus it proved, and a very agreeable surprise at that. It afterwards appeared that the visitors had silently assembled in the lower parlor and laden the table with bridal gifts, when the door was suddenly thrown open and some of the family invited in to find the room well packed with friendly faces, all of which was the quiet work of that mistress of all good management, Mrs. Bixby. One of the most elaborate gifts, in silver, was a cake basket, a bouquet of crystallized geranium leaves of rare varieties encased in glass was charming. But the presents were too fine to permit a selection. Mr. S.P. Bancroft gave an opening address, a very kind and graceful speech, which was replied to by Mrs. Glover Eddy with evident satisfaction, when alluding to the unbroken friendship for their teacher, the fidelity to truth, and the noble purpose cherished by a number of her students, and the amount of good compared to others of which they were capable. The happy evening was closed with reading the Bible, remarks on the scripture, etc. Wedding cake and lemonade were served, and those from out of town took the cars for home. Little imagination is needed to describe the scene when the last guest had gone. Mary, always ready to hope for the best, happy in the evidence of so much affection and peace restored, and Gilbert, methodical and almost womanlike in his care of things. He could do up a shirt as well as any woman, as his sister-in-law once said of him. Happy because she was happy. Moving quietly about, tidying the room, putting chairs back in their places, stacking up the plates and carrying them to the pantry, and putting the remains of the wedding cake back in the cake box.